When people push back on policies, taxes, for example, it's not always obvious to policymakers why.
This is truly big data that we're creating, but it's big data on something unusual, namely big data on what's happening in people's minds. I am Stephanie Stancheva. I'm a professor of economics at Harvard and founder and director of the Social Economics Lab.
Stancheva's fascination with not only economics, but other disciplines like psychology and sociology has led to an impressive body of research from studies on how taxation affects innovation to discovering why people turn against things like the carbon tax. And she does it by asking people what they think.
What we do with these surveys is to really take a deep dive into people's reasoning, why they reason the way they do, why they hold some views, not others. And so this is actually a way to really rigorously understand the gap between what we actually measure with our headline statistics versus what people actually experience.
In this latest installment of our series featuring the exceptional work of women in economics, this year's recipient of the prestigious Clark Medal, known as the Baby Nobel, awarded by the American Economic Association for the most significant contributions to economic thought by an economist under 40. Stephanie Stancheva sat down with journalist Rhoda Metcalf to talk about her research.
You've been involved in a long list of thought-provoking studies, but one in particular has garnered a lot of interest recently, and that's your work on taxation and innovation. So can you lay out for me what you discovered about the connection between these two things?
Yes, it's a really important connection, and we often have this idea that innovators or inventors are like mad scientists that don't care about economic rewards or financial incentives, but in the end, they are also economic agents like others, and they do, to some extent, care about their economic rewards. So in a series of papers, we study what has been the effect of taxation in the United States on innovation, on inventors. We go really back in time, all the way to the 1930s, and try to understand how did corporate income taxes and personal income taxes shape the quantity of innovation that happened, where it happened across different states, and its quality. And we find that taxation definitely has a negative effect on innovation, both in terms of the quantity as measured, for instance, by the number of patents that are produced, but also on their location. So states that had higher personal or especially higher corporate income taxes were states that lost out to lower income states in terms of innovation.
Right. So are you saying that if a state wants to have more innovation, like more startups, more cutting edge business, they need to lower their taxes?
It's a little bit more complicated than that because taxation is there for a good reason, right? We need to raise revenues in order to finance important public spending. And what we see in the data is that if a state actually has a lot of amenities, measured, for instance, by the number of other inventors that are already located there, by the research infrastructure, then this has a really dampening effect on the effects of taxes.
So it's a countervailing force.
Exactly. Take California, for instance, you know, that has relatively high taxes, yet there are so many other people located there doing innovation that inventors want to be there, in a sense, despite the higher taxes. And because of all the amenities, the infrastructure that is there, in part financed by those taxes.
It's not just the weather in California that draws everybody?
We don't have that in our analysis, but it's not just the weather, I believe. It is all these other amenities that are, in the end, often funded by the tax revenues.
So it's a complex balance.
Absolutely. And by the way, this is also true internationally. So it is not just across U.S. states historically, but also within major patenting countries, for instance, Western Europe and Canada. There are these migration effects that we see, especially for very qualified inventors, like the superstar inventors, which we see as being highly mobile, actually, and sensitive to taxes. But I think that the policy conclusion here is that Because taxes are needed for lots of reasons, it is important to think about how can we dampen these effects? How can we dampen the negative economic costs?
Right.
And the way that revenues are spent is going to be really critical. So revenues that foster, you know, the research infrastructure, mm-hmm. innovation infrastructure, that make it attractive for people to want to be there, are going to have a really beneficial effect that would allow a state or a country to sustain, you know, the higher taxes that it might need for other reasons without losing all its innovative capacity.
Right, right. Interesting. Taxation is really a recurring theme in a lot of your research. What is it about taxation that makes you want to dig down into it?
It's a great question, because taxes might appear something really, you know, boring, and who likes taxes, who likes paying taxes,
indeed.
Especially. But when you think about taxation, it's something that is so omnipresent in our lives, whether you notice it, you know, when you have to file your income tax return, you definitely notice it, or whether you don't notice it, for instance, at the cashier, when you've paid a sales tax, it's a daily thing for us that affects so many aspects of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And a well-designed tax system can be one that, you know, encourages growth, encourages more equality, provides a lot of great infrastructure and public spending. But a poorly designed tax system can have all these terrible cascading effects and really hamper economic development. So to me, it's such a powerful tool that governments have that makes it so important to study and to get right.
One thing that really sets much of your research apart from other researchers is the way you use surveys. And certainly surveys are nothing new, but you've figured out how to use surveys in a way that produced some very interesting insights. So can you give me a sense of how you do that? And why is it that you like using surveys so much?
Absolutely. So you're right that surveys have been around for a very long time. And in economics, we have used them for a really long time for measurement, you know, measuring the unemployment rate, measuring people's incomes. But there are other things that remain completely invisible in data, no matter how good it is. Things like people's reasoning, perceptions, beliefs, attitudes. And this is what is so appealing in the surveys that we do at the Social Economics Lab, where we try to understand how people think about economic issues and economic policy.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very much not like your standard opinion polls or, you know, the doctor office surveys, but they're really going in depth into how people reason, why they reason the way they do, why they hold some views, not others. They also typically incorporate something experimental, which means some people will see some types of information, others will see another type of information.
Okay.
So we can see what happens from that extra information or that different angle on an issue.
Whether it changes what they end up telling you in the end.
For instance, exactly. And we have applied this to many different economic issues and policy issues, inflation, trade policy, both of which are quite topical at the moment, climate change, and taxation, of course. What is important here is that this is truly big data that we're creating, but it's big data on something unusual, namely big data on what's happening in people's minds. And the reason I say this is because this means that we can analyze it, you know, in a quantitative, analytical way.
Mm-hmm.
And we can come up with patterns that are there. We can understand cause and effect. And so there are so many lessons we can draw from this. For instance, we often see by looking at how people think or reason that we might be missing or misunderstanding some things. By we, I mean we researchers. And that our models and our settings need to be augmented to incorporate something that is really important.
Can you give me an example of this?
Absolutely. So in a project on climate change and climate policies that we did in 20 countries, we try to see how people understand major climate policies and how they feel about them. And the carbon tax, which was, you know, a policy that was tried in several countries, including France, and led to lots of protests and backlash, had this issue that people considered it to be really regressive, that it would mainly hurt low-income households. But once we actually dig further, we see that people are actually quite favorable to a carbon tax if the revenues are reused in more progressive ways, or if the revenues are used for environmental purposes.
Right.
So people are actually worried about revenues going back to the general government budget and being wasted in some way. So the more progressive the use is, the more people are favorable to this tax. Another interesting example is this trade-off between taxing pollution or taxing a polluting good versus banning it altogether. So think about, for instance, polluting cars. Mm-hmm. Should we tax polluting cars and still let people purchase them if they're willing to pay the price, or just ban them altogether?
Right.
Economic theory would often suggest that a tax is more efficient. It's the better tool rather than an outright ban. But people feel quite differently. And our surveys allow us to understand why that's the case. And it turns out it's again driven by the strong progressivity or equity concern. Namely, people find it, you know, inequitable or unfair that richer people can simply pay to pollute,
right,
while others cannot. And so they actually consider an outright ban to be more fair. At least that way, nobody gets to, you know, do that polluting thing or purchase that polluting car.
Right. Interesting. How do you get people to participate in these surveys? I mean, a lot of people I know would say, no, thank you to surveys. How do you get all those thousands of people to take part?
Most often it's through commercial survey companies who have, you know, panels of respondents, and people are rewarded for their time in various ways. What is very interesting is that most often people are used to taking surveys about specific products or for market research, and they actually tend to find our surveys very interesting. So we often receive actually quite positive feedback that the survey was really interesting and that they learned something.
Mm. You don't worry at all about that there may be some bias in surveying people who are willing to take money to do a survey versus the rest of the people who don't?
We worry about this all the time.
Right.
So we have a lot of ways to try to, you know, either correct for that or prevent that. You know, first, the rewards can be very different. So not just, for instance, cash rewards, but other types of rewards like hotel points, frequent flyer miles.
Oh, yeah.
So to already select different groups of people. We can also always check that our surveys are nationally representative or representative of the groups we're targeting, such as age or income, occupation, etc.
So you started out as a child in Bulgaria, as I understand, and you've lived in several countries since then. Was there something in that international upbringing that drew you towards economics?
Yes, I was actually really exposed to a lot of economic things before knowing what economics was.
Right.
Starting with my childhood in Bulgaria, I still remember the hyperinflation that happened in the 90s. That was actually very shocking. Prices were changing at a stupendous rate, and everybody was talking about it. There was a currency peg, so people were talking about the exchange rate. These things that, as a child, I had no idea what they were, but they seemed really, really important.
Right. The people around you were talking about, and your parents, perhaps, were talking about it.
Exactly. And later, when we moved to France, it was very striking to me, you know, how much inequality there was relative to Bulgaria. I also lived in Eastern Germany, and the contrast to West Germany was so big. It just begged the questions to me, why are things like this? What is driving this? And it's only much later, basically in high school, that I discovered there is a discipline that's called economics that actually deals with exactly these questions.
Right.
And at that point, once I realized that, it was clear to me that I was going to study economics and be an economist.
So are there no other economists in your family then?
No, there are no other economists.
Right. Are there academics in your family though? Or is there a leaning in that direction?
There are no academics either.
Wow. So you're is your family sort of fascinated by the work you've ended up doing?
Well, I talk to them a lot about it, so they know it inside out, and they're incredibly supportive, and they give me some great ideas too. So it's wonderful to have them and talk with them.
Hmm. And what about the social economics lab that you created at Harvard? What was the impetus for that?
Labs in general are becoming much more common in economics as we have moved towards more big data work that is very, you know, conducive to this type of lab structure, very much like in other, you know, natural sciences. For me, the social economics lab was really inspired by this wish I had to, after studying taxation for such a long time and public policy, I really wanted to understand, you know, how people think about it and what we can do based on that to improve policy design.
Right.
And so the notion of social economics comes from this idea that economic agents make a lot of decisions, taking into account the social context and social issues, so that these two are really inextricably linked.
Yeah, absolutely. And your social economics lab has created some really intriguing studies. One I found particularly interesting was your work on zero-sum thinking. Can you explain what that is? And also, you know, what you've learned about how this kind of thinking plays into policy debates?
Yes. So What is zero-sum thinking? It's a belief that if one group or one individual gains, it must come at the expense of another. So it's the belief in a limited amount of good. You know, if you get a larger slice of the pie, this means I must be getting a smaller slice of the pie. Right. And it contrasts with positive-sum thinking, where you believe that some things can just make everyone better off. You know, we can grow the pie. We don't need to be all in such direct competition with each other.
Right.
And so we set out to study how this mindset, you know, is spread across the U.S., across different groups, across different generations, different places, and how it shapes our policy views, as well as where it comes from. And a striking pattern that we see is that zero-sum thinking is much more prevalent among younger people in the U.S. So that might be a little bit surprising, but it's also true in other rich countries. And where does this come from?
Yeah.
What we see is that the economic environment really, really matters. So people, generations that grew up in times with lower growth and lower mobility, mm-hmm. as is the case for younger generations in the U.S., are much more likely to be zero-sum.
Right, to think that there's a very finite amount, and if I get some, then you don't get as much.
Exactly. And this is also true in other rich countries where the same pattern holds. Growth used to be higher, mobility used to be higher. And so the younger generations today are more zero sum. And the pattern is flipped in developing countries or emerging markets where today there is higher growth and higher mobility than, you know, before. So there, the younger generations are less zero-sum than the older ones. Hmm. But the economic environment also matters at the individual level. So if your own family has experienced upward mobility, then you are less likely to be zero-sum today.
So you believe in growth. You believe that the pie is getting ever bigger because your parents got more than your grandparents and you got more than your parents did, that it's ever growing.
That's right. So this really fosters this more positive sum thinking mindset rather than a negative zero sum thinking one. And what happens in terms of policy views? What is really interesting about zero sum thinking is that, unlike so many other things today, it is not a partisan issue. So it's sort of evenly distributed across both sides of the political aisle. It is not the case that one political group is more zero sum than the other systematically. It does, however, explain a lot of within-party variation in policy views. So people who are more zero-sum are going to want to basically have more intervention for the government to step in and sort of protect the group that's suffering from the zero-sum situation.
Okay.
For instance, people who are more zero-sum are going to support more redistribution, you know, driven by this idea that the gains of the rich come at the expense of the poor.
Right.
They're also going to support more policies to help minorities that are discriminated against. Mm-hmm. They're also going to be more anti-immigrants, again, driven by this idea that the gains of immigrants come at the expense of non-immigrants. And so it's interesting to think about this in light of this fact that younger generations today are more zero-sum and, you know, trying to think what this can do in the future to our policies.
So from a government point of view, do you think that there's anything governments can do to shift this kind of thinking, especially if it runs counter to the kinds of policies they're trying to advance?
Yeah, so we're still trying to study, that's very much work in progress, whether this mindset is very sticky, very fixed, mm-hmm. or something that could potentially be changed, and what type of, you know, either information or interventions could change it. So on that point, I would say stay tuned.
Right. What made you interested in studying zero-sum thinking?
It's actually a really interesting story because it came from anthropology. Mm-hmm. There was an anthropologist in the 60s called George Foster who I think coined the term. He was studying small-scale agricultural societies where resources were probably quite limited and truly scarce. And he coined this idea of the zero-sum mindset that might have been quite prevalent in such societies. Mm-hmm. And by looking at his work, by looking at today's debates, it seemed that it actually has a lot to say, and that's how we got really interested in it.
Hmm. So you read a lot of anthropology?
I don't read a lot of anthropology, but sometimes you stumble on these really interesting things from other fields, mm-hmm. and you can build on them and expand on them.
Well, because, I mean, your work also leans into other disciplines like psychology and sociology, etc., right?
Yes, and I've learned a lot and benefited a lot from those fields, so I do try to really read widely. Psychology, sociology, political science are probably the major ones where I'm a big consumer of the literature and that have contributed a lot to my thinking.
Interesting. So I know you have a lot of other irons in the fire in terms of research, but if there's one question you'd really like to dig down into in the near future, what would that be?
So right now, I'm very fascinated by the role that emotions play for our policy views.
Okay.
Since we spoke about the influence of psychology on my research. So there's a rise in emotional content in politics, whether it's on social media, in campaign speeches, or in Congress. So we have a recent paper that we're still very much working on, trying to document this rise in emotions. Hmm. And interestingly, the predominant emotion seems to be anger.
Right.
That is the one that is most rising. So we want to understand, you know, what is happening, where this comes from, and then what it does to our views. So this is very much what I'm interested in right now.
It sounds like making the leap between emotion and economics could be a little difficult, no?
It's definitely difficult, but it's clear that this is something important that is happening and that is, you know, shaping the policies that are going to get implemented and are going to get passed, the economic policies. So I think it is something that is, although difficult, just really important to understand.
Well, I think your work and the methodology, how you put these studies together, is really fascinating. Stephanie Stancheva, I thank you so much for being on the podcast. I'm going to be following your work with a lot of interest.
That's so very kind of you, and thank you for having me.
Again, that was Stephanie Stancheva, professor of economics at Harvard, and this year's recipient of the prestigious Clark Medal. She was speaking with Rhoda Metcalf. Look for the other podcasts in our Women in Economics series at imf.org/podcasts or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.